Hi, this is Dave Pryor, and welcome to Leading Agile Sound Notes. This is iteration 7, and today we're going back to the very beginning. So Chris Bagnola is taking some time out of his day, and we're going to talk about innovation. So Chris, thanks for taking time away from work and from your cold to help everybody get, you know, a better sense of what's going on in the innovation space.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be back on.
So we talked last time about, well, actually, before we get into that, can you, for those people who are just joining for the first time, could you give them a brief overview of the work that you do and the work, you know, how you kind of are helping Leading Agile redefine its approach to some of the base camps and innovation, things like that?
Sure. Yeah. So the work that I'm doing with Leading Agile is really around helping enterprises who have become a little bit stagnant in the innovation space really understand how to implement some of the lean startup practices and act a little bit more like startups do in terms of really bringing innovative concepts to market as quickly as possible. So in terms of the whole Leading Agile Basecamp model, we're talking about kind of the upper right quadrant, Basecamp 5, really advanced practices kind of stuff. So that's mainly where I'm working right now.
Okay, cool. All right, so and last time what we talked about was, what do we mean by innovation? Like, how do we put all that together? And today we're going to take a focus on a sort of a different aspect of it, which is the value system behind it all, right?
Right. Yeah, and this is kind of the foundational layer that we want to build all of our structures and all of our practices going forward on. So when we think about building out an innovation team, we're really talking about building an innovation system, right? And any good system design or system thinking person is going to start from values and principles. So that's what we want to start with today, is really just talking about what are those foundational layers that we need to think about that we're going to filter everything else through and say, this actually fits with the value set that we're trying to build around this innovation team.
Okay, so if you're listening, one of the things I do want to point out before we get into this, because when Chris and I were talking before the interview, I said, okay, so I'm a guy in a big company. I want to do innovation. Like, what are the tactical takeaways? And can you sort of explain how you responded to that?
Okay, so yeah, today is really a lot about the philosophical underpinnings to what we're trying to do with the innovation teams. So this set of values is, like I said before, it's really going to be the foundation that we want to build organizational structures off of, all of our practices, the tool sets that we're going to be using. We want them all to kind of fit within the filter of this set of structural values that we're going to talk about today.
Okay, so where some of the future, and we're going to talk about a lot of podcasts around innovation, and some of them will have very step-by-step do these things approaches, but this is the bedrock. This is the thing that that puts the fertilizer into the garden so that the innovation can grow.
Exactly.
Okay. So what kind of fertilizer do we need? What are the values that come behind that we need to have instilled in the organization before we can have a place where innovation is going to be able to survive and take root?
Yeah, so I think about it, we talked about this a little bit last time, and, you know, I have 6 definite values that I really believe in and a 7th that I keep waffling on. So we can definitely talk about the waffle today too. But the primary ones I think about mostly are autonomy, adaptability, creativity, urgency, focus, and accountability. So those are the 6 that I really am focusing on. And then there's this other piece about ownership that we sort of touched on last time. Yeah. And I keep going back and forth about how much the enterprise needs an ownership piece as well. But I kind of look at these values as something in this startup group, this innovation group within an enterprise that has to look different fundamentally from the enterprise itself, because we're trying to separate them out and say, if the enterprise created the problem that we're trying to solve, we shouldn't be acting the way the enterprise does. We should look slightly different than that. So these values may or may not align with how the enterprise currently acts. So it could be quite a shift for the enterprise to start thinking about these values in a different way.
So if I'm in a big company, we're going to need to split off some piece of something and give it the okay to be completely different and have a different value system and different culture than we have in the organization.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So that's got to be weird. Like, if you're a lot of the companies that are really big and really successful, they believe very strongly in the things that got them to that point, even though what got them to that point is also what's going to keep them from taking the leap into the next point.
Right.
Do they sorry, they have the self-awareness to know to do that?
That's a great question. And I would say you really have to have that gumption to be able to look in the mirror as an enterprise and say, what got us to this point? And do they have the self-awareness? Some do, some don't, right? Okay. So there are some enterprise folks that I've talked to that, you know, when we go talk about this with them, there's not even that awareness of we need to be thinking this way, or we need to be thinking differently, or we're no longer innovative because of how we've acted along the way. And then there are some that are super aware of it. And they're like, we know that kind of the stifling bureaucracy or lack of autonomy or, you know, lack of focus, whatever it might be out of these values that we're talking about, some of them are painfully aware that that's the problem. What they can't figure out is, how do I get out from under this big, huge weight that's the enterprise to start acting differently, right? And that's what we're trying to get them to do is, we don't need the whole enterprise to start acting differently at once, but if we can take a small team of 6-8 people and get them to act differently than the enterprise, that could be the great starting point for them.
It sounds to me, the way you just described it, I'm kind of picturing it in my head, like the ones who have the self-awareness are going to be running around in this blind panic, worried about somebody drinking their milkshake and scrambling to try to find some way to be different. Whereas the other side, they can be like, no, we're good. It's all good. Is that kind of the tone that they take, or the people that are already aware of it, are they like, we have to do this right now?
Yeah, most of them know they have to do something right now. They're not sure what it is or how to do it or what got them into the bind. Some of them can point to like one thing that got them into the bind, and it may be, you know, we're so focused on day to day, we're not picking our heads up about innovation stuff. So there might be this lack of focus kind of thing. The ones that are not self-aware, it's really tricky talking to them, because you kind of talk through Christensen's whole innovator's dilemma thing, and they look at it and go, well, that's not happening to us. And
then you start, we're better than that. We don't have that problem.
Yeah. And then you start pointing it out, going, okay, so you don't know you have that problem right now, but you're going to. So we need to talk about this. Like, you don't want to be that guy who the startup comes and disrupts you, and now you have to react. Like, what you'd really rather be is the guy who's reacting ahead of time. And some of those self-aware ones, non-self-awares, they're not quite there. You know, they don't want to look at it and say, that's going to be us eventually. So the ones that are self-aware, they know where they are on that curve, and they know what's going on. And usually they can point to at least one of these values as being a problem they need to fix.
But it's still, I don't know. I imagine the gig's got to be weird, because you're there saying, yeah, the sky is going to fall any minute. And you know it's going to happen. They may have an awareness that something bad is going to happen. But how do you get them to a point where they can have discussions about these values and kind of lock in on how to foster them within their organization?
Yeah. So the way that I approach it is, you know, we probably sit down and really start having an honest conversation, and we'd bring these 6 or 7 values into the conversation, get them on the board, and really start walking through one at a time. What are the honest problems here? And we need to create a really safe environment around that. And I find that that's actually a bigger issue than anything else. Like, I think deep down, a lot of people know where the issues are with their organization, but a lot of times there's not that safety net to talk through these things, right? So as a consulting group, you know, Leading Agile has to come in. We have to help you create a safe environment where we can actually talk through these things and really understand where the problems lie. And it has to be, for us to be able to help and for us to be able to collaborate with a client on getting these things moving, we have to really build that safety zone, right? And we have to get them to be comfortable enough to talk with us and be honest about where the problems lie here and where the gaps are. You know, as we go through these values, there are some things that are really hard for an enterprise to swallow in this set of values. You know, they look really easy up front, but when you start implementing them, they're not that easy. So like getting them to understand, like, here's where you are. Here's what would be ideal for you to be. What's the gap, and how do we start closing that? That's a huge conversation, right?
And hugely painful for the people in charge, because you're saying, I mean, I guess it's the same as the company. Like, if I'm executive, vice executive, I got to that spot by doing things a certain way. And now you're saying, yeah, you're going to have to let go of a bunch of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the status quo has an amazing pull, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of, this is how things are going. And we have this organizational inertia that rewards the way we're currently working. And now you're asking me to do something different, which is really risky for me. So getting that executive level buy-in that, like, this new group is going to kind of exist in a small bubble at first until we can prove out that, like, hey, this thing really does work in your organization and you really can support these values without upsetting the whole apple cart, right? And again, it comes back to what we said before. We're not asking the whole organization to change. We're asking, you know,
just a small part.
Yeah, you know, if we're talking about a 3,000-person organization, can we give six people this set of values to work with as an experiment? And I think that's the way we really need to frame this as we talk to people about it, right? And enterprises need to understand that too. We're not asking you to make this huge tectonic shift on your own. We're there to help you. We're going to take a small part of the organization and do this experiment with them. And if we approach it as an experiment, I think it's a lot more palatable to everybody, right? It's not, you have to do this and everybody's going to change tomorrow. It's not a huge transformation. Small group, small experiment. Let's see if this works for you. And if it does, then we'll make continued investment in this.
So I want to go back to something. There's two things I want to ask about. One of them was at the end of what you just said, but one of them was a little bit earlier. For the reward system, how would you recommend, like, let's say that, you know, I'm a company, I'm totally set on this, take these six or seven guys and do something awesome with them. The reward system, can that be modified? Should it be modified? Or is the pursuit the reward?
Oh, so we're down on the ownership question, huh?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you brought up rewards. So that's the first thing I'm thinking is, like, nobody wants to fail and not get their bonus. But what are you going to give them a bonus for? Failing 1,000 times? I mean, that seems really weird, too.
No, I don't think it's failing 1,000 times. And I don't think – so let's just hit the equity ownership thing, right? Like,
okay.
Doesn't have to be an equity stake, you know, and that's something – that I'm struggling with, right? Like, as a startup, it's always an equity stake. You always want that equity at the end of the deal. If I put a bunch on the line and I'm taking a cut in salary to go work for a startup, I want the back end of the deal to be worthwhile for me. At an enterprise, that's not always realistic, right? In terms of reward, though, I think we have to stop thinking the way the status quo works now, right? And the status quo now is really focused on rewarding execution. And these innovation teams, they're not focused on execution. They're focused on learning. So we have to really readjust what we're going to reward people for. So it's not going to be, we're going to reward you for repeated failure, but it should be, we're going to reward you for, hey, how many experiments did you run this month? Out of those experiments, what did the learnings look like? How did those learnings translate into effective pivots in the product or effective kills in the product or even perseverance, right? So we really want to look at this group a little differently. So the measure of how we're going to reward them has to be based on a different set of metrics than we currently reward people on in the enterprise.
Well, this is why I'm asking. This is a follow-up to something that you and I discussed on the last one where we talked about the risk and reward people and how the startup folks, like, that, you know, they'll take the risk, but they want that big payoff at the end. Mm-hmm. There's people like me who, having gone down the wrong side of that path, like, I don't want the risk and I don't really need that reward. I'd rather, if you say, hey, just go build cool stuff, that sounds pretty awesome to me and I don't have to get paid a bucket of money at the end. Right. I mean, so that's what I guess what I was getting at is, can the reward system shift? And does that mean that you need to find certain kinds of people? Like, if you put seven people who are all, like, equity focused on a startup team in a massive company, I would expect that as soon as they got good at working together and had a couple great ideas, they'd all quit and go do something on their own.
Yeah, that's a definite possibility, right?
But you want people that are going to stick around and continue to do, like, Bell Labs level, you know, let's create some really awesome new things that completely change the world.
Exactly. And honestly, that's why, you know, I keep waffling on this whole ownership thing. You know, do I want a total entrepreneur sitting in that seat? Because like you just said, a true entrepreneur is going to go, I can go do this without this enterprise, right? I can do this by myself. Where somebody who's a little bit older, more mature, you know, just looking for a place where I can go be innovative, go be inventive, but still have that safety net of the enterprise behind me. I think you can still do that and still provide a good incentive for them on the back end too. You know, I think there are different models that work on the ownership piece. So personally, like I said, I keep adding ownership and taking it out, and I haven't settled it in my head yet on what's
ideal. Well, I think it's really about it. I mean, there's going to be people that are driven by that reward. But, you know, if you remember when we were kids, MacGyver, MacGyver didn't even get a paycheck. He just had everything he needed, and that was cool. You know, there's got to be people out there that are super creative that want to work that we can find in pockets and companies and pull them together and just say, here, do some neat stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you brought up MacGyver. It's almost a perfect segue, but I don't want to jump away.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
So MacGyver, like, comes to my mind every time I start talking through, like, values and the constraints and stuff. And he's actually the perfect guy, right? Like, he was, well, I mean, he wasn't motivated by anything but getting out of a jam.
Well, he had that awesome mullet, too, so.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, I kind of think of MacGyver an awful lot when I'm starting to think about these values and stuff, because sometimes, like, one of the things that a lot of people will say to me when I first start bringing up the values and the principles and the constraints on the system is, you know, this is supposed to be an innovative, creative group. Why are you putting all these constraints? Why do you need all these values and stuff like that? And, you know, if you think about MacGyver, like, his all of his creativity was inspired by his constraints, right? He was always in this jam. He never had everything he needed, but he had to find his way out. So he had to find this creative solution. That's kind of how I see all of these values, right? Like, all of these values, in effect, are putting constraints on a broader system. And I think that all of those constraints and all these values end up giving us a much more creative space to work in, right? People are going to find more creative solutions inside of these constraints. So sorry for that little segue, but you brought up MacGyver.
No, I keep thinking
of him. He's perfect.
But it actually got me thinking about it too. So creativity, you're saying that's a core value. It's something we have to have present. But when you're talking with organizations about this, I'm assuming that there have never been organizations where if you brought up creativity that they would say, yeah, we don't value creativity. We don't support that. I mean, they all think they're creative, right?
Yeah, you know, nobody wants to say they're not creative, right? It starts from kindergarten. You know, we all want to be creative and we all want to color outside the lines. The problem that I see with the creativity value is that a lot of people and a lot of organizations just rely on creativity to emerge, right? And they think that creativity is this innate thing that either you're creative or you're not. And I'm going to stick creative people together and really cool stuff is going to come out of them because they're creative and it just naturally flows from them. And, you know, in a former life, I was a graphic designer and I can tell you flat out that, like, creativity doesn't just flow, right? You really have to work on engaging that creative rather than relying on it to emerge. So there's lots of different things you can do around that, you know, and I don't want to dive totally into practices, but you have to be able to look at that group and say, what do we need to do with this group? What should we give them that helps creativity emerge, right? So Pixar is great at it. I had a chance to be in at Pixar for a little while a few years ago, and they just do really cool stuff, right? They do, like, these improv things together where it has nothing to do with work, but it just gets creative juices flowing, right? There's lots of different creativity boosters out there that you can go do. I had a group that I worked with. We were working with municipal electric companies and stuff like that. And they kind of thought I was crazy at first. And I was like, no, I need all the product managers and product leads to get out and start doing creative things that just get their mind thinking differently instead of the same way they always did. So we would go out and take walks in nature just to let that stuff absorb. We'd go to, like, local art museums just to let creative things start to permeate yourself and let it start coming out. Like, you have to cultivate that creativity. It's not just an inherent turn the switch, everybody here is creative kind of thing.
Do you find when you're trying to kind of restart that part of people's brains, that juxtaposing different things against each other, creating a conflict in how they look at stuff? Like, I worked with a designer who took all the graphic guys to a motorcycle exhibit because he said, building a website's exactly the same as building a motorcycle, which as a sentence sounds completely ridiculous, but I'm imagining if you can get yourself to a point where you can see that connection, that's already a creative space. It's sort of like a trap door into that, which is what you're trying to kickstart this thing these people used to have, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many ways to do it. And, you know, your example is a great one. Just give them something that conflicts and let them, like, understand.
It
feels weird to them, right? So another thing I did with product managers that I had working with me, they were really stuck. So a colleague of mine when I was at Rally had this awesome exercise, and I just adapted it based on, you know, his exercise. But it was like taking these, you know, the foam insulation tubes that you put around copper tubing.
Yeah.
Well, we took those and sliced them in half, and we were going to build marble tracks out of them, right? And I gave them a set of constraints, and it was like, you know, here's the basic requirements of the marble track, and for every foot that you can build on your marble track, you know, you get 10 points. And then we started throwing like crazy stuff at them, little weird requirements and everything else. And, you know, they were allowed to do anything they wanted in the conference room, climb all over, push ceiling tiles out to give you a better starting spot and everything else. They had so much fun in that exercise. And like, it had nothing to do with building anything that we were building. But like, you just saw A, the creative spirit come out. And then all of a sudden, this collaborative spirit too, of like the teams competing against each other and like trying to figure out better ways to do what they were doing, right? And they went back to work that week. And like, it took a little while for it to sink in. But like the week after, you know, they started talking about it. They're like, you know, that exercise really helped. Didn't think it would. I thought it was kind of stupid when we first started it. Then we had a bunch of fun and we all laughed and I didn't really get why we did it. But now I'm sitting here and, you know, I'm approaching things going, well, what if I did push the ceiling tile out? And what if I did wrap this around the statue in the corner and stuff? Like, they started thinking, you know, outside that figurative box in terms of the regular daily work that they were doing.
So let me play devil's advocate with this, because this is a really interesting thing to me. I think it's, I mean, there's lots of information out there about how to get people to be more creative. And, you know, the book's about just draw anything every day, or just, you know, one thing you do every day. And it is like a discipline to train that part of your brain. It's a muscle that you have to work out and build. But what the organization wants, a big enterprise organization, is not a bunch of people running around who want to move ceiling tiles, because that's just going to end up with a bunch of crappy art to put on the fridge. You want good stuff.
Right.
So one, is it the application of like the accountability and the urgency? I mean, are there the ways these different values kind of pin together to compress this thing that's going to galvanize the creativity and drive something great? Or is it, we're just going to create a bunch of art for the fridge and then see how the market reacts until we find the right thing?
No, it's definitely not the latter. So, okay. So all of these values have to work in conjunction with each other, right? We want to engage the creative side and we want people to start thinking really crazy ideas, right? But we also need a sense of focus. And that focus and the urgency and the accountability, those things all come together, right? And they kind of, this is the MacGyver example, right? They kind of focus that creativity. So there's this thing, Trevor Owens talked about it, and I love the way he talks about it. And it's this whole idea of an innovation thesis, right? And he goes back to how VCs, venture capitalists, have investment thesis, right, on what they're willing to invest in and what they're willing to look at. And if we adapt that to the innovation group and look at an innovation thesis and say, you are free to explore whatever you want inside of this general area. And here's an innovation thesis of places we would like to explore in. So it doesn't just give you that free for all, go be creative. And, you know, if, you know, we're going to go develop refrigerators or something like that, if we're not a refrigerator company, we want to kind of focus that creativity, right? So that's a constraint on the system. And that's a value at the same time, is real focus. So we have vision and direction to the experiments we're going to do. Urgency is the same kind of thing. If we put a financial runway in your way and you only have a certain amount of time to come up with an idea that's going to reach a product market fit, you're going to be less likely to go play all over the place and really stick to a focus group of things that we think have potential in the market. And then, of course, you have accountability, right? We're going to have accountability for our results at some point. You know, we need to decouple from the organization and break apart dependencies so that our accountability is solely on that group. But that group is still going to be accountable eventually for bringing some idea to market that we can say, hey, there was some value that came out of this group. So those three values, while they seem to run counter to creativity, you know, we're going to constrain that creativity. We want to really get it to emerge. We really want to get it to be engaged, but we need to focus it with a couple of other values balanced against it.
So one of the ones that, I guess there's two things that I don't see, and maybe they're just, I'm not seeing them, maybe they're put together differently, but two things that I would expect would be competition and discomfort. I mean, there's got to be something that's going to create you can just make stuff, but if you have some level of uncomfortableness of some problem you're trying to solve or whatever, you know, like what's going to create the punk rock at these companies? Is it that through the urgency?
I think it's through urgency in some respect. And, you know, it goes back to our conversation before about, are you self-aware or not, right? The self-aware organizations are really able to pin that sense of urgency back to a real market condition.
Okay.
So in that sense, you know, we have a financial client who is totally feeling the sense of urgency, right? And I think we talked about them last time. I can't remember. But, you know, they have somebody who's giving their product away. There's a startup who's literally giving their product away.
We talked about that last time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that they have a definite, concrete sense of urgency, where other ones that aren't so self-aware may need to be creating kind of this false sense of urgency through a financial runway or something like that. But yeah, I think that's where that next punk rock is going to come from, right? It's got to be something that says, if we don't do this, here's where we're going to end up on that innovator's dilemma curve, and we don't want to be the laggards. We want to get back out ahead of this thing.
Yeah. Okay, so what about the competition thing? Because one thing I could totally see happening would be is at a company, you'd end up with this Shark Tank-like thing. Like, you know, you all go off and have your fancy ideas and come back and pitch, and we'll let you fight against each other to see which idea gets the money at the end. I mean, one, does that happen? And two, is it healthy?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So I'm not a big fan of the whole everybody pitch ideas and we're going to find the one that works the best and fund that, mainly because I don't know that competition is always the healthiest way to go about it, right? I think we want a group that we can kind of set aside and say, your whole charge is just to go work out here and come up with something innovative, and then we'll roll it back into the enterprise. I don't like the whole Shark Tank approach. I think it actually, and I've seen it in, you know, real practice, really bring out a lot of bad behaviors in people, where if we don't have that kind of mentality and it's strictly a, this group is pre-funded to go out and do work, I think that actually engages a lot more collaborative spirit than the whole Shark Tank approach.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would think that to an extent, you'd learn how to game the competition and game right. The people that are judges, as opposed to being somebody who's pure about this experimental creative approach.
Right. You know, and I know we'll talk about metrics down the line on product success and stuff, but what I'd love to see organizations focus on is less about predicting ahead of time, where do we think we should be investing money? That whole Shark Tank approach.
Yeah. Hey,
they're going to come and pitch us and we'll get that. What I'd rather see is really organized experiments that are looking at, do these product ideas, are they gaining traction in the market? Are they moving towards product market fit? The ones that are not, we're going to stop investing in by just killing it, right? The ones that are showing promise but need some work, we'll probably make some pivots and keep moving towards product market fit. But I'd love organizations to start looking at these innovation teams and using the appropriate lean startup metrics or the innovation accounting metrics to really judge how much more should we keep investing in product idea X instead of the whole everybody's going to pitch and we're going to just take a shot that one of these is the right thing.
So along those lines, I mean, how important is it if I work at a company and I want to create this type of, you know, an innovation space within the organization? And let's say that we're going to fund multiple teams trying different products, you know, running experiments. A lot of those are going to fail. And that should be expected and is not an unhealthy thing. And it's part of, I mean, it doesn't even seem to me like it's part of the risk. It's just part of the process of an organization learning to be something different than what it is. But for the people that are working in these areas, obviously they want to succeed. But am I correct in assuming you want to create an environment where I know even if this thing tanks, I'm still going to have a job because the company values my creativity more than me being able to perceive the future and understand what people actually are going to want?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. This is kind of the benefit that I see of these organizations, you know, large organizations engaging in enterprise innovation teams, right? Is we want to create this safe environment and say we want really adaptable people to go work in here. And that's one of our other values, right, is the adaptability thing. We want somebody who can go into this group, be totally cool with all the big changes that are going to happen, all the learning that's going to happen, all the pivots and all the failures, all the ups and downs that come along with being part of a team like this. We need the organization to support that adaptability. We need the people who are in that group to be adaptable, but we also need it to be a safety zone, right? Where, okay, if you don't make it, you still have a seat back on the bench where you used to work, right? So to me, this comes back to, if we kind of limit this thing to a, like maybe a 3-month experiment up front and say, let's see how this thing goes and let's set up the appropriate metrics on how we're going to evaluate the innovation team on building an innovation capacity. Then we're going to set up the appropriate metrics to see how their product ideas are moving towards product market fit. Then if those don't work in 3 months, we have the option as the enterprise to look at it and go, we don't think we're going to invest this way anymore, and we pull the plug, right? And you have a seat back where you used to work. That's got to be the benefit of doing innovation in an enterprise. If it works, great, we'll keep funding you and you can keep going. But yeah, there has to be that safety net of your job still exists here if this enterprise innovation team shuts down.
Yeah, it's having a bunch of ideas. So you were talking about it, and my brain started to spin a little bit, and I'm thinking it almost cultivates a different kind of worker. And I was having this little thing going on in my head until you said you go back to your old desk, because I was thinking it's really about becoming this journeyman of innovation. So, but that also kind of speaks to the ownership thing. I think maybe part of this is, what you need is Waz. Like, you want a bunch of Waz laying around so you can send him onto these teams and he can have these crazy ideas and build stuff because it's cool to build stuff. But you also need somebody else who can do that entrepreneurial side of it. But let's say that the whole thing tanks. Don't you want to keep the Waz guy on the team because he's super creative? Or do you want to send him back down to accounting or wherever he came from and let him go back to not being on the Rockstar team?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question, right? Is, suppose we spin up this innovation team and it doesn't work for some reason, right? And now you have to go back to your day job. That's going to kind of suck for whoever it is who's going back to their
right.
day. I know I wouldn't want that to be me, right? So you're right. I think that could feed into the ownership play, right? Where you kind of look at it and go, here's your options. We fund you for 3 months and you go back to your desk if it doesn't work. But if it does work, you're on this team as long as you want to be. Like, if somebody told me that, I would work so hard to make that team work. Like, that would be my ownership stake, is I just want to do this. I don't want to go back to the dungeon, right?
Right. Well, it's also, but I mean, if you think about, like, the example that I'm having in my head is the band that played on David Letterman's show with Paul Schaefer and Will Lee and Sid McGuinness and Anton Figg, or Fear, whatever his name was. So those guys, they could have been massive players in massive bands, but they got to go to the same place every single day and play with the greatest musicians in the world. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
That is the coolest example. Yeah. I'm digging that. Yeah.
But you don't have to. I guess the thing is, like, you don't have to. This is what I mean about a different type of employee in an organization. It doesn't maybe have to be the guy that wants to go out and be like the next Steve Jobs, as much as you're going to need people like that, but you're also going to need the people, they just want to be with the creatives doing new stuff. And yeah, we'll build something new the company can use, and then we'll go build something else new the company can use.
Right. But I still want to be able to go to my kid's soccer game after work, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I mean, you know, personally, I think that's where I am in my own life, right? Is I love doing all this creative, innovative stuff, but I like having a regular job at this point.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of people in organizations who are like that, that can fit into here. I think you're right, though. I think you need a mix of people in here. And I think, you know, you're probably going to have one person who's going to head the group, right? And I think that person needs to be the real entrepreneurial spirit, because they're going to be the ones that are going to drive the group in a startup kind of direction. And then I think you have the mix of, you know, really creative people in there who are looking for some safety. And then there might be some really creative people who are risk takers. And I think that blend is a good thing. But I do believe really firmly that the person who's kind of running this, who's the, you know, mini CEO of the internal startup, needs to have that real entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah. So what about the autonomy thing? We haven't talked about that yet. So can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny we're getting around to that one at the end, because I almost see that as the most important piece of this. And it's mostly because when I think about where I've been before, and where I think about where I've seen enterprises fail before, is that they don't give groups like this enough autonomy. And it comes back to the status quo conversation we had before, where, like, most things that happen in a large organization really happen to further that organizational inertia. And it's all because there's no autonomy, right? There's a financial tie to the organization through budgetary constraints. There are usually political ties. There are resource constraints that are part of the organization that really constrain what and how we do things.
Right.
So I think that by carving off a group and saying you are fully autonomous, and you know, there's a far edge to this and a near edge. And I think the far, like probably over idealized version of this is create a whole new legal entity outside of the enterprise, right? That is completely autonomous, gives the enterprise brand protection. It gets them out from budgetary constraints and really sets up a venture capitalist to startup relationship between the enterprise and this new group, right? And the enterprise is the investor, the startup is out there, and the enterprise keeps investing over time in that startup out there, and the startup has full autonomy. So that is really hard for most enterprises to wrap their heads around, and I'm not sure how feasible it really is, but I think there's something closer to what exists in the enterprise now where we can kind of carve it off and say, okay, we're not going to make you a separate legal entity, and we're not going to treat it as an investor to startup relationship, but we are going to give you your very own budget that you're not going to have to compete for. And whether that's something like, you know, $200,000 over the next 3 months, and we'll see how that goes, and then we'll do incremental investments after that. Maybe it looks something like that. But what I really would love to see is that that group is not accountable to the enterprise the way the rest of the groups in the enterprise are. I think they need to be treated differently. I think they need to be, we talked a little bit before about like success metrics for them.
Yeah.
Their metrics need to be different. They need to be evaluated differently to give them a sense of, we are not going to treat you the same way we treated everyone else in the enterprise. Because if we look back, the enterprise, the way it exists now, is what is creating the problem for us. So we really have to look at it and go, how do we break you guys and girls aside over here and make you something completely different? And to me, that starts with autonomy. And then all of these other values fall out of that. But I think autonomy is actually one of the biggest keys to say, it is okay to not act like the rest of us because we want you to do something different than what we're doing now.
Yeah. So you mentioned, when you said brand protection, like all, I kind of hit a wall, because that to me seems to be really, really important or is going to be for a lot of large organizations when it comes to the idea of experiments and trying things out and publicly failing. Because that's going to be part of this, right? I mean, that could have a huge kind of stain on, if you are, you know, a massive Fortune 100, you know, on everybody's lips company, you don't want to fall down in front of people.
Yeah, and that's something, that's why I really like the idea of going out to that far edge and really creating something completely separate that's off-brand that doesn't really, you know, incur that risk to the brand. Because that's a problem a lot of brands have is, we would love to go try this, but if we stick our name on this and it fails, like huge in the public, like what do we do with this thing? So to me, like, you know, if you can do experiments while you're still part of the enterprise and keep it off brand, that would be great. Creating something that's completely separate, that's even better. You know, you're kind of far out there. You can name it whatever you want to name it. Whatever they put out there doesn't have to be associated with the brand. If it hits, then we just roll it back into the brand, or the brand buys it back if we set up a separate legal entity. You know, like, we can look at different structures around what that legal entity looks like. You know, the enterprise can own 51% of it, so they're a majority shareholder in it, right? If anything hits, they can buy it back or buy their equity back, however we want to structure that. But like, yeah. I love that idea of having something separate. I just don't know that many enterprises are willing to do something like that.
Well, you also run the risk of creating an independent culture that is so severely different from the one that is back home that you can't really fold it back in. That the people are the rock stars who've gone off to their little special startup incubatory area when they're faced with the big, coming back to the big building, like, no way, man. We're cool. Yeah, we don't do that.
Yeah. So this is something I struggled mightily with. So when I was putting this together, two of the guys who helped me form a lot of this, they're no longer with Leading Agile, but Richard Hensley, and Michael, they both of them, you know, I was working with them and we kind of struggled with this as well. We really kept talking about what do you do with this group that becomes so different from the enterprise, right? Part of it is like, do the values that we build in this group, do they start to affect the enterprise? And does the enterprise start changing their value system to align more with this new group? Or does this new group become something so radically different that they do need to spin off and go be their own thing because they can't coexist? And I'm still struggling with that. Like, I want to, like, we're just getting started down this road with enterprises in general. And like, it's so untested of like, how do you roll that stuff back in? And what do you do with those superstars? Like, do you let them go off on their own now and be a majority shareholder in whatever it is they're developing and be happy with that and say, great, we're making, you know, 40, 50 million a year off of that thing. So let's let it keep going and maybe spin up another innovation lab. So now we have like, you know, A, B, C innovation colonies or labs running as these things start hitting market fit. And I kind of like that model, right? Because it's really hard that if this group becomes independent, builds its own product and gets it to product market fit, they understand that market better than anybody in the enterprise does. So it's really hard to roll that back in.
Yeah.
And on top of it, like you said, you created this really different culture. So how do you roll that back in? So do we leave them out there and then just spin up another one of these things and keep spinning them up? And as they hit a product market fit with a product, let them run and become that product owner for that group and spin up another one? Or do we take what they developed and try to throw it back to a regular development team? That's a really tough nut to crack. And I don't think anybody's got the solution for that right now.
Well, and I want to bring up one other point about this, is that this is an evolving space, right? I mean, it's not like this is stuff that is totally locked down and codified yet. People are still finding their way with it in the larger organizations. I mean, they know they want it, but how they make it work is still getting its feet, right?
Yeah, there are a ton of questions on how this is really going to work in enterprises. And there are quite a few people who are scratching their heads and trying to figure this all out, right? And we're one of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of unanswered stuff in here right now. There's a lot of proven stuff as well, though. Like if we look at all the lean startup methodologies and all the metrics that we'd like to track these teams on, that stuff on the micro scale for startups, well proven, you know, this stuff actually works.
Yeah.
It's really, how do we make it work within an enterprise that's not used to working this way? That's the big mystery, right? And it's the $1,000 or $100,000 question. How do we carve these groups off? How do we maintain? To me, the biggest question really is, how do we maintain them after they have a hit? And I think you hit it right on the head at the end, is they have a big hit. They're a totally different culture. How do we deal with this now, right? So I think that's a huge question. And yeah, totally unexplored space right now.
Well, do you think that splitting them off creates, let me think of a different way to ask it. Is that the way to cope with the struggle that you would normally have in a larger organization? Like, let's say we're going to switch to Agile. Huge cultural upheaval, right? Because they have to exist within the culture that's already there, but we want them to be different. But if I take seven guys and I say, okay, you go work over there, forget about everybody else, that culture can evolve quicker independently into a new state, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about a huge enterprise-wide transformation. So for seven people to create a new culture,
yeah,
it could happen in a matter of weeks. I mean, you can start to see huge differences in a couple of weeks where these people are behaving totally different than they were when they were constrained by the bigger system.
Is that a metric for you? I mean, when you're working with teams, is that something that you want to, that you would measure or track in the beginning? How different are they?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I haven't thought about that. But because I've mainly been approaching it, you know, the metrics question for them in terms of how they're running experiments and how fast they're moving through it. But
yeah.
But how much they've changed culturally, that's really interesting. I'd like to dig in on that a little bit of like, how do you actually measure? Have they become more autonomous? Are they more focused? Like, you know, think about some of the metrics around that. That's something I might want to dig into. That's cool.
Yeah, cool. All right. So we're going to keep doing these. And the next time, what are we going to focus on in our next conversation?
All right. So the next time we'll talk about, you know, we got into a lot of side conversations today in this value section. But why don't we next time take the values and really start to look at how we craft a system around this? And that's what can the organizational structures look like, and maybe different structural types for these lean innovation teams. We can start to look at the structures. We can start to look at some of the practices and the pros and cons of each one of those structures too. So we can start to look at something a little more concrete about how do we start to build these teams and what do I need if I want to build one of these? What do I need in terms of these teams?
Cool. All right. And so if people want to get in touch with you or learn more about your work, what's the best way for them to find you? Other than obviously they can go to Leading Agile and look you up there, but where else should they reach you?
Right. So email is Chris at Leading Agile. Email me any questions you have. I'm on Twitter at Chris Spagnolo. And if you check the notes from this, it'll have my name in there.
Yep.
So it's just my name. Let's see, other places. I'll be at Agile 2015. So if you want to connect there, I'm totally open to that. And then otherwise, leave comments on the podcast and we'll respond there as well. So any way you want to get in touch with us, totally works.
Cool. All right. Thanks, man. Thank you for taking the time out today and good luck with your cough,
which
was pretty much absent during our podcast. So that's pretty cool.
Well, the voice is struggling, but we got through it. So thanks a lot for having me. I love talking about this stuff.
Cool. Me too, man. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Bye.